Video gambling machines were meant to bring in money for the state, but as a ProPublica Illinois investigation found, it's actually created both financial and social costs. Here's Jason Grotto on WBEZ.
The legislature had said that these machines would bring in $300 million a year starting in 2010. Well, it wasn't until 2017 that that happened. In the meantime, the state started borrowing billions of dollars.
Plus, the federal government shutdown has started to hurt crisis center hotlines for sexual violence in Illinois. We'll hear from the Illinois Coalition Against Sexual Assault on how they're trying to keep things running. But first, what should Governor Pritzker do about our education system? In his inaugural address, he said he'd increase K through 12 teacher pay and funding for higher ed.
We will approach education with a holistic mindset, recognizing that students do their best in community schools where teachers are paid well.
We'll talk with educators about what they hope to see from our state government. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. I hope everyone's staying safe out on the roads today. Make sure you're checking the forecast. Lots of ice out there. Coming up this hour, how the shutdown is affecting our statewide sexual assault crisis hotline. 80% of their funding comes from the federal government. Also, when it comes to video gambling, Illinois has more places to gamble than any other state in the country. But how is that paying off for taxpayers? And in the meantime, what are the social costs? ProPublica Illinois shares its investigation with us. First, though, we're continuing our series talking to different stakeholders throughout Illinois about their hopes and goals with the change of government in Springfield. So far, we've talked to folks in the manufacturing, retail, and to a variety of social service agencies. Illinois faces significant challenges at every level when it comes to our education system. College isn't affordable for many. Our public schools have gotten unequal funding for years, and we see inequities even before students start kindergarten. That's why this morning we wanted to speak with educators about what they want from our new governor, J.B. Pritzker, along with our state lawmakers. We're going to be speaking to educators at all levels, including University of Illinois President Timothy Killeen, but we're starting with our youngest Illinoisans and early childhood education. Christina Pasonia Zayas is the director of policy at the Erickson Institute. They're an educational organization and graduate school that focuses on early childhood development. She's on the line from Chicago. Hi, Christina. Good morning. Welcome back to the 21st.
Good morning, Nyla. Thank you for having me.
So, Christina, Governor Pritzker has been a national leader when it comes to early childhood education and helping fund this. Not very many people may know that about him, but I wonder what it meant to you personally to see someone who's taken such a leadership role in early childhood education take office as governor.
This is just a major gain for early care and education, the field, and essentially for young children and families. The fact that we don't have to start at ground zero with explaining the advantages of investing early proactively and mitigating long-term consequences if we don't is just truly a gift to have a kind of closer starting point in terms of our work. And so I'm really excited, not only with, you know, his experience in early care and education, but also the Lieutenant Governor, Juliana Stratton. She was one of our executive fellows of our McCormick Foundation Executive Fellow Program. And so she has become a lot more attuned to understanding the importance of investing in early care and education.
And in fact, in an interview with WBEZ and with Chalkbeat, that's an education news site, last fall, Governor Pritzker said he wanted to create a path to universal 3- and 4-year-old preschool. No other state has completely implemented something like this. It's also, of course, expensive. Do you think this is a good idea?
It's one piece of the equation. I think, you know, universal preschool for 3- and 4-year-olds is only tackling the latter portion of early care and education, that spectrum. I think really where we really have to look is at that birth to age 3 spectrum, because that is really where 85% of the brain is being developed. And that's where you have the greatest return on investment. James Heckman, Nobel laureate economist, has been able to quantify that every dollar invested in the birth to 3 continuum results in a 13% return. And so that is really significant. And I was really excited, actually, when Governor Pritzker in his inaugural address said that he would like to advance proposals to implement paid family leave. Right now, there's only a handful of states that require that, and it's one of the most critical benefits for ensuring that infants have the strongest start, families are set up for success with providing care and attention to the health, social, emotional, and development needs for their children, and that employers retain talented employees. I did hear the segment with your business leaders commenting on the administration, and this is actually an economic strategy as well. So it just, for me, I think we need to think about these birth to three investments because it really does set up young children at the earliest point for success.
And so what would you say as a counter to businesses that say policies like paid family leave are too expensive and they can't afford to pay for it?
I think you have to look at it as a long-term investment. You know, when you're thinking about the demands on businesses to have highly skilled employees, you want to retain your talent. And in the 21st century, we need to be nimble with that. And we also just need to have some common sense policies. When we set children and families up for success to meet their most basic needs, the research bears out that those long-term benefits will always, always outweigh the initial investment. You know, for example, when you think about it, young children develop in the context of relationships, right? And so from a logic standpoint, Illinois doesn't even license facilities and homes for infants under the age of 6 weeks, and employers don't offer paid leave. So how are children and families being set up for success? And paid leave lays this foundation for what we call secure attachment in the field. And that is that there is a consistent, attuned, and supportive relationship between a child, a parent, or a child, and a caregiver, because that's developmentally expected and biologically essential. Science has been able to prove that the absence of secure attachment or these relationships is a serious threat to child well-being, and this absence activates body stress response systems, which has highly detrimental lifelong consequences. So you have to think about this as an investment in society, and you can't just be thinking about the short term.
That's Christina Pasione-Zayas, the policy director for the Erickson Institute in Chicago. Christina, thanks for that, giving us some ideas for what we can look for when the governor has his budget address. Some other things we'll be keeping an eye out on. Thank you, Christina.
Thank you, Nyla.
I wanted to move now to K through 12 public schools. Robin Staines is the president of Advance Illinois. They're a nonpartisan group that advocates for public education. Hi, Robin. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hey, thrilled to be here.
So I wonder how, when we think about K to 12 education, we certainly heard a lot from Governor Rauner as he was leaving office about what he thinks he accomplished over the past 4 years, especially when it comes to school funding reform. How would you characterize the last 4 years?
So, and I know you're asking about K-12, but I'm going to necessarily think about it from birth through higher ed because it's really all connected. I think the biggest challenge that Governor Pritzker is going to have after the last 4 years is the baseline budget that we're dealing with. We have, unfortunately, really disinvested across the educational continuum. We have lost ground in the number of kids who are able to get to preschool. We started some pilots for universal home visiting. And by the way, I just want to echo everything that Christina said. It's critical that we get those first 5 years right. It's critical in particular, we tend to ignore the birth to three, and it is nice to have a governor who gets all of that and who I think is going to be naturally drawn to that work. But for the first time, we have kindergarten readiness data around the state. It came out for the first time this past spring. And we looked at kids' cognitive development as well as their social and emotional development. And what we saw is that 24% of kids were coming into kindergarten ready to go on all of those domains, and a full 42% weren't ready on any of them. So if you can't expect, and then the state has also set a goal of saying we want 90% of our third and fourth graders to be reading at grade level, because that's such a powerhouse indicator of how successful they're going to be later in their academic careers and in life. We're currently at 35%. If we don't move those kindergarten readiness numbers, if we don't invest, not only invest more dollars because we fell behind, but invest them more intelligently and in more strategic ways, you can't get from here to there. You can't get to 90% of our third graders and fourth graders where they need to be. And if you don't get those third graders and fourth graders, you're going to hear from President Kalina or whomever you talk to next, we're not going to get kids where they need to go in terms of that transition into college and into career with any success. So, you know, money is not the answer to all things, but there's no question that there are investments that are needed. And we had some huge budget challenges over the last 4 years, and we're all paying a price for that, our youngest learners, our K-12 learners, our higher ed. That said, we do have an equitable formula now. Coming into that formula being passed, 183 of our districts in the state were funding below 60% of what they should have been spending on their kids. That's down to only 14 districts now who are below 60% of adequacy. That's huge. That shows how powerful that new formula is. But the bad news is 60% is a pretty low bar. If you now look at inch it up and say, okay, let's set our sights higher, how many of our districts are able to spend at least 70% of what they ought to be spending for their kids to be successful? Half of our districts, only half of our districts are spending 70% of what they should be or more. So we've got a lot of work to do.
And Robin, that said, right, so then if you think of that bar, so 70% of what they should be funding, so if we're looking at 70% of what they should be funding are devoted to students, what kind of numbers are we talking about when it looks at K through 12 education? How much more funding do you think the state needs to be devoting to this?
Well, the good news is we've got a plan. So the plan agreed when at the same time it passed this more equitable formula, the state pledged to put $350 million new dollars into K-12 education and into that formula every year for 10 years. So that's a total of $3.5 billion. If we're able to continue doing that, that's huge. That is significant. And that is so I think there's a lot of pressure, a lot of people paying attention, and a lot of pressure on the new governor to do that. I think the challenge is that we've got significant bill backlogs. We've got swelling pension obligations. We had a deficit. You know, I mean, it's just going to be a huge challenge. So I think anybody who cares about education, I don't care what piece of the education continuum you care about, you've got to care what the big picture budget plans are of this governor and of his new team. Because if they don't have one, we're not going to be able to put that next $350 million in, and our kids are going to continue to pay a really significant price.
Can I ask you just one last question, Robin, about minimum teacher salaries? Last year, Governor Rauner vetoed a bill that would have raised the minimum to $40,000 a year within the next 5 years. Is this something that you all are hoping will come up again in this session?
So, well, the bill has already been refiled. Senator Menard's, and I think there's some other co-sponsors now. So the bill will certainly be discussed and up for discussion. And I know it passed by big margins last session. I think the deeper and broader question for Governor Pritzker and for all of us, teacher quality is significant. I mean, it's the single most important driver of student success is having a high-quality teacher at the front of the classroom. And there's no question wages play a role in that, but it's a much bigger challenge for the state to make sure that we've got more teachers who want to come into the teacher pipeline, that they are good at what they do, that they're getting the training that they need, that they're diverse and they reflect the diversity of their student body. And unfortunately, again, because we had so many budget shortfalls, there were a number of strategies the state had been trying and wanted to try that simply couldn't be funded. So we're behind. We're behind in making sure that we've got that pipeline where it needs to be to get good teachers into those classrooms. I think minimum wage is part of that conversation, but I think it's only a part.
That's Robin Staines, president of Advance Illinois. Thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
You know, Robin mentioned a challenge of getting teachers. There's also a big challenge in the state in keeping our college students here within Illinois. And we wanted to end our discussion on education today with higher education. Timothy Killeen is president of the University of Illinois and joining us now. Hi, President Killeen. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, thanks. How are you?
Good, thank you. I understand recently, President Killeen, that you were able to meet with Governor Pritzker. What was the main priority you wanted to get in front of him?
Yeah, I did. And first of all, let me just say it's a thrill to follow Christina and Robin because we are all part of the spectrum, and thanks for the opportunity here. Yes, I met with him face-to-face with Jesse Ruiz, who's one of his deputy governors, just before Christmas, and had an extended, very good conversation. I came away actually really, really happy, thrilled to see the emphasis on education writ large, but also the important role of higher education. And he talked about many of the things that we care really deeply about, access, diversity in all of its dimensions, affordability, the concerns about student debt, keeping students in Illinois, which you already just mentioned, is an important priority for him as it is for us. And then, in our mantra, we go through to completion so that students achieve their credentials and so forth and join the workforce, and then success in civil society. So I think he's very keenly interested in the full spectrum of what higher education brings to the state, and seemed to resonate with our perspectives that this is a time to invest. It's time to really turbocharge the overall effort to influence the economy, to keep our talent base in the state, to provide world-class educational opportunities, and to do that with excellence, integrity, and scale built in. So I couldn't be happier with the conversations. We've been following it up with some of the other folks in the new administration, and of course, paying close attention to the speeches and so forth, and looking forward to the budget address in February.
President Killeen, as you think about the idea of MAP grant funding, I wonder how important is that funding level for students to have those monetary award assistance program available for college students?
It's critical. It's critical for the students to have the financial backing to make it and to get through college. We all know the advantages that a college education brings in the workforce. We've demonstrated that with our econometric studies, and we do know that student debt has reached intolerable proportions just nationally, and that the financial impediments, particularly for students coming from not the wealthiest family backgrounds, are big and significant. So we've been working hard, as I know you know, to keep our costs down. In fact, we've had 4 years of a tuition freeze for Illinois residents. And we see that combined with the MAP grant and making the MAP grant process year-round, we strongly support that, and also incrementing it, because all those students who actually qualify for MAP are not able to get, so we don't have enough going into that budgetary vehicle to meet the demand. And these are talented, college-ready kids who deserve the leg up, financial leg up, to be successful in college. So we're very supportive of MAP, and during the last several years, even during the budget impasse, we made sure that no students lost their financial backing. And that's our commitment going forward. And I know affordability writ large is very much
on the big issue. President Killeen, we're going to have to take a little break here. If you can just stick around, we'll continue this conversation with University of Illinois President Timothy Killeen after the break. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is University of Illinois President Timothy Killeen. We're talking to him as we speak to different stakeholders across Illinois about what they would like to see out of the new government in Springfield as we've had a change in leadership. President Killeen, the last time you were actually on The 21st was to talk about the Discovery Partners Institute, a research institute in the South Loop of Chicago. Governor Rauner, yourself, Mayor Rahm Emanuel unveiled that last year. Governor Rauner at the time originally announced a total of $1.2 billion for the project, $500 million of which would come from the state. First of all, has Governor Pritzker told you that he's going to continue to support this project?
Yeah, Governor Pritzker was very positive when we met about DPI and IN. He wants to see the philanthropic dollars come into focus, and we're making really good progress, particularly with the $500 million that was appropriated from the state. And we have, in addition to that, about $300 million of non-state funding. And, of course, we're working hard on the philanthropic component. So things are moving very quickly and expeditiously with that. DPI and what we call the Illinois Innovation Network are really designed to build out the economic capacity, keeping our students in the state, providing them opportunities to work in companies, to work with companies, to get internships, letters of reference, all the things that are associated with this sort of meeting the academic mission with the private sector mission. And it's moving very expeditiously, and Governor Pritzker has told me he wants to be a cheerleader for it. So I'm very bullish about where we are, and it's moving quickly. And of course, we have some land specifically designated, and we have a university signing up as major partners, and there'll be another one tomorrow that we're going to be announcing. So it's moving forward very expeditiously, and we think it's our approach to providing what we call a land grant mission. It's, you know, the back in the Abraham Lincoln days, it was about academia supporting public good through societal economic development. This is the modern version of that, and we're very excited at the partnerships that have proceeded to this point, and delighted to be working with the new administration.
And to the point of the philanthropic dollars, I know that you were hoping former Governor Rauner would contribute as a private citizen. Has he said he intends to contribute?
I haven't been able to talk very recently with Governor Rauner, but intending to do that. No, he was a very strong booster of this overall program and spoke very positively in lots of public settings. And we don't see this as a partisan kind of issue at all. And we're anticipating that there will be many donors to this that will see the value and see the excitement in supporting our students and economic pursuits and research and development at this very, very high level. So I would stay tuned for more announcements as we move forward. DPI exists. We've opened up the office suite on Wacker Drive in Chicago. We've had several meetings there. Classes are being taught. We're recruiting staff and faculty. So it's very much a going concern. We've come a long way since we last spoke.
President Killeen, within Springfield, there's been a movement over the past year to better deal with sexual harassment claims and allegations. And in light of that, I wonder if you've heard anything from any state lawmakers or the incoming administration about the university developing a better policy around sexual harassment following last year's incidents. I'm thinking of law professor Jay Kaysen, among other incidents.
Yeah, we've had many conversations actually predating the law school incident that you're referring to, and had many conversations with the legislative community, with our internal community. Of course, we do have policies in place that we adhere to very carefully, and they're published. But we are now looking at reviewing everything that we're doing with a perspective of trying to get the national best practices in focus. So I've appointed a task force under the leadership of my deputy, Bob Wilson, at that meeting, and now has had two very excellent meetings to get started on this. We've got some external consultants. So we're going to take a look. It's not to say that anything's fundamentally wrong, but we want to make sure that we're operating with all of these policies at the best that we can ever be to protect our students and to have the appropriate policies in place to deal with issues as they arise. And timeliness, frankly, in my mind, is one of the things that we need to focus on. We need to make sure that we move forward in expeditious ways as these things happen. As you probably know, we have 86,000 students under our wing across our three universities. So we have a lot of young people, and we need to double down and make sure that we have the right kind of policies in place. So I anticipate there'll be some tuning as this task force responds. But each of our three universities is also looking internally at the policies and procedures. So these conversations are ongoing, and we'll be moving forward in the next months.
President Killeen, we started this conversation talking about early childhood, birth to three. We talked about K through 12. No matter who we talk to in the education sector, one thing that we consistently hear is how important the idea of stability is from our state government. And I wonder what your message is to Springfield about how a reliable state government affects students.
I think it's pivotal that we're able to plan effectively and to use our resources most wisely on behalf of the public citizenry of our state, this wonderful state that we're blessed with. Stability in outlook is very important. We just went through a period of volatility that was made it very difficult to really focus on the long-term optimization of what we do. So reliability, predictability of funding is incredibly important, and we have a whole legislative agenda that's built around that we've introduced in the past, and we're going to be reintroducing, that looks to establish a five-year outlook in stable funding in return for the university signing up to specific metrics on outcomes, graduation rates, debt levels, numbers of Illinois residents, diversity in our populations, et cetera. So the stability in a funding outlook is incredibly important. I think for most complex organizations that have to plan ahead, particularly in academic settings, I would just echo the comments of Christina and Robin about that. It's time to invest in education. It's the best investment that the state can make in itself. We've shown in our own work that an investment from the taxpayer into the University of Illinois system returns 17% to 19% a year back to the tax base. So it's better than my retirement, and I think better than most retirements. So it's an investment in prosperity. And I think your comment about stability is pivotal, and thanks for picking up on that. It's not just the level, it's the fact that we can plan accordingly with a multi-year outlook. Because our students, as they come in, they're up for 4 years of intense study, lots of homework, et cetera, and they deserve an institution that has that kind of stability too. So I'm all for that, and we have our own legislative thinking about that, which incidentally is bipartisan and has moved very well, and we're going to be reintroducing it in this session.
Tim Killeen is president of the University of Illinois System. President Killeen, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Nyla. Appreciate talking to you. Bye.
When you think of gambling, what comes to mind? Maybe the bright lights of casinos in Las Vegas or Atlantic City, but try thinking a little closer to home. Perhaps your local bar, truck stop, or restaurant that's home to video poker or slot machines. Back in 2009, Illinois lawmakers legalized video gambling. And now, with more than 30,000 video slot and poker games that's outside of casinos, Illinois officially has more places to gamble than Nevada. Actually, we have more places to gamble than any other state in the country. Revenue from video gambling was originally meant to help bail Illinois out of our financial problems, but the reality of the past decade of video gambling has been filled with both fiscal and social costs. That's according to some investigative work done by ProPublica Illinois. Reporters Jason Grotto and Sandhya Kambampati have been investigating this with WBEZ. The first part of their multi-part series, The Bad Bet, was released last week. They're on the line with me now to tell us more. Hi, Jason, Sandhya. Welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being here with me.
Thanks for having us.
Jason,
thank you.
Yeah, Jason, I think it's important to start by pointing out not just that Illinois has more places to gamble than any other place in the country, but that none of those video, whether it's poker or slot games, are in Chicago, right?
That's correct. The city of Chicago has a 100-plus-year-old ordinance that bars any kind of gambling in the city without a referendum to opt in. The rest of the state, the Video Gambling Act allows communities to opt out of video gambling, but that's one reason why Chicago doesn't have it right now.
And Sandhya, are the machines then in a specific part of the state? How many locations are there throughout Illinois?
Yeah, there's they are all around the state. There's over 1,000 locations throughout the state. There are over 1,000 cities that have these machines. There's over 6,700 locations that have these machines. They're in bars, truck stops, VFWs all around the state. And what we found is that they're actually in predominantly in lower income areas, targeting, you could say that they're targeting vulnerable populations.
Hmm. So, Jason, I wonder if we can go back to 2009 when legislators first passed the Video Gaming Act, and this was actually the largest gambling expansion since creation of the state lottery in the 70s. Can you tell us more about the actual process of getting this legislation through? Was there a lot of planning that went into this?
No, unfortunately, there wasn't. In fact, there was no studies or any kind of research done on what the impact would be on the state. The law, which started out as one of these what they call shell bills that had to do with something completely different, was an amendment was made, and it turned into a sprawling piece of legislation that provided revenue for a building program called Illinois Jobs Now. And it passed within 48 hours of being introduced. The gaming board itself didn't even find out about the legislation until a week before it was introduced. It's, you know, in the context, it's important to understand that at the time, you know, the state and the country was going through the Great Recession. Unemployment had reached double digits. There were homes being foreclosed upon. It was also an election year. Rob Blagojevich had recently been impeached and indicted, and former Governor Pat Quinn was up for re-election. So there were a lot of political issues at play, and really what the lawmakers wanted was some kind of capital plan to both help the economy and also probably to have something positive to run on.
Cynthia, did that happen in terms of the money payoff? When have we started to see a payoff from this from a taxpayer standpoint?
Yeah, well, we found that it was supposed to generate $300 million a year, but it took years and years to ramp up that, and it didn't actually hit that target for about a decade, so basically until now.
Wow.
And then the issue there is that, you know, rather than wait for the revenues to be realized, the state just started borrowing right away. So it actually, you know, hurt the state on a lot of levels financially because they didn't have the money that they thought they were going to have to cover the debt service on the loans that they took out. And so it required them to draw from other resources.
So they borrowed in anticipation of getting revenues that didn't come in right away, Jason?
That's correct.
Okay. And then, so you also looked at, so we were talking about the financial costs of this, but then there are also the social costs of this. And Jason, you've been speaking with people who were affected by this increase in video gambling. Cindy, as you're pointing out, these are all locations outside of Chicago. A lot of them are in lower income areas. I wanted to play a clip from you guys' reporting that you did on this. This is actually from a Gamblers Anonymous meeting in Downers Grove. And this is a woman you spoke with named Anne, who only wanted to use her first name.
Because you have these machines coming up all over the place, you're going to have people that never thought they had an addiction all of a sudden having addictions, and there's nowhere for them to go. There's no help for them. There's no monies for them.
Thanks to WBEZ for that audio. We're talking to ProPublica Illinois reporters Jason Grotto and Sandhya Kambambati about this investigation they did with WBEZ for along with ProPublica Illinois. Jason, to that point, what have you heard from people who have been, how are you hearing from people directly affected by having more places to gamble throughout the state?
Yeah, we have. We've gotten a lot of response over email, and we have a form online with our stories that people can fill out and tell us their stories. And we've heard from people all over the state. You know, there have been studies now for many, many years that have shown that the density and access to gambling opportunities drives the rate of addiction. In 2013, the American Psychiatric Association classified gambling disorder as an addiction similar to drugs and alcohol. And studies that have taken place over the past decade show that if you look at the brain chemistry, it's very similar to drugs and alcohol. So while, you know, gambling addiction manifests itself in a relatively small percentage of the population, you know, when you're talking about a state the size of Illinois with machines literally all over the state, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of people that are impacted by this. And the state did virtually nothing on the front end to examine what, you know, expanded gambling will have on that population that's prone to addiction. And since we built the largest video gambling market in the country, there's been very little else done about it. Illinois is one of only a handful of states that hasn't even bothered to study how bad the problem is. And, you know, we're going to be having another story about this subject coming out in the next week or so.
And so after the break, we are going to continue this conversation with Jason Grotto. He's a reporter for ProPublica Illinois, Sandhya Kambambati with him as well, as he's talking about this Bad Bet series. The first part of it was released last week. They have more that's going to be coming out next week, focusing on the addiction side. When we come back from the break, your point, Jason, John Kint is going to join our conversation. He's testified before Congress and the state legislature about the effects of decriminalizing gambling. And in particular, John, when you join us, I want to have him talk about the whole idea of video gaming and how different that is, if that's more addictive or less addictive than sort of the traditional wheel that we know, the kind of fit lever that you pull. So stay tuned to the 21st. Just after the break, we'll pick up this conversation. Thanks for tuning into the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Right now, we're talking about the fact that Illinois officially has more places to gamble than any other state in the country. ProPublica Illinois reporters Jason Grotto and Sandhya Kambambati have been investigating this with WBEZ. We're talking about their series. John Kint is also going to join our conversation now. He's a professor emeritus of business administration at the U of I. He's testified before Congress and the state legislature about the effects of decriminalizing gambling. Hi, John. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for having us. Appreciate it.
John, as we were listening to Jason describe these machines and whether or not this, basically the fact the state hadn't put anything into effect to help people who may have problems with gambling addictions, are these machines, if they're video machines, does that change the fact? Is it easier to become addicted to them than the traditional machines that we may think about in Vegas where you just pull a slot?
Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, the gambling industry calls these the crack cocaine of creating new addicted gamblers. And we have seen substantial increases in the numbers of people who are getting addicted to gambling. And now the major expansion last October 17, I was before the Illinois State Legislature along with others, and it's very apparent that there's a major expansion slated for Illinois, and what they want to do is they want to put this gambling 24/7 on cell phones and on kids' video games. So that's coming straight out of this video gambling concept. Actually, the medical, psychological, psychiatric communities call these electronic gambling. These video gambling machines are the gateway drug. The crack cocaine of creating new addicted gamblers. And obviously the trend of the industry is they want to go after young adults and even kids because they realize that that's where the market is, and that's where they're going to make their what we call a cream market. That's where they're really going to get the bucks.
Jason, what is the state? What does it look like with the state with looking at expansion? What age limits are there in the proposals right now?
Well, right now, video gambling is limited to people over the age of 21 and over. So it's similar to alcohol. And you know, the new, you know, there's a whole bunch of ideas out there in terms of trying to expand gambling, mainly to try to bring revenue to the state. You know, as you just had on a bunch of people about education funding, you know, everyone's looking for dollars, and a lot of lawmakers see, you know, gambling as sort of a painless way of bringing in money into the state coffers. But the fact is that oftentimes they overlook that there are costs associated with doing these things, that it's not something that you just put online and there are no costs to it.
John, to that point of the costs, what would you like the state to do when it comes to providing more gambling addiction treatment services or to restrict that?
Well, the best way you can prevent the addiction is not to increase the gambling. Psychologists and the medical community talk about the ease of gambling, the speed of gambling, the what they call the accessibility factor, that is where you put gambling on every street corner. And that, of course, is what these video gambling machines do. Now, let me go back in time a bit to our former U.S. Senator Paul Simon, who back in 1992 proposed and in 1995 established the Congressional U.S. National Gambling Impact Study Commission. And it said the conclusion of the commission, which included gambling interests on it, said whatever you do, don't put these video gambling machines on street corners and in bars and where people have easy accessibility to them, because you're going to increase the number of addicted gamblers. And yes, indeed, the commission also was finding at that time that where this had occurred, there was an increase within a 3 to 5 year time frame of double the number of addicted gamblers. We talk about the war on drugs. Well, you've created a war on gambling, and you're going to have more and more people that are hooked on this. University of Illinois and our researchers actually, among other news media, worked with 60 Minutes on this some years ago, and they came up with an investigative report called Slot Machines, the Big Gamble, which visualizes many of the things which these Jason and Cynthia, your reporters from ProPublica, have indicated. And by the way, that is an outstanding work that they've done. I was on a conference call literally this morning with a couple of dozen colleagues from around the country, and they are citing repeatedly to that great work that these reporters have done. So I have to give them kudos for informing and educating the public and showing that the gambling emperor is wearing no clothes.
Thanks for that, John. Let's end. Cynthia, can I ask you just about the second part of your investigation? That's going to be, I know, I think Jason said sometime this week. I know it focuses on addiction. I just wanted to end by asking what the state, if how much of that you can give us a preview of in terms of what the state is spending on addiction services and the like.
Yeah, what we can say is, the story is coming out sometime next week, and basically the state of Illinois has spent less on video gambling addiction services now than it did before video gambling was in place. And we found that there's a lot more gambling now in Illinois, and the fact is the state actually hasn't given out more than, you know, $800,000 in any given year. We dive into the number of people that we kind of look at that are affected by this issue. The state hasn't done a prevalence study, so they don't really know really how many people are affected by this issue. And so we take a closer look at that.
So we'll look out for that next week. In the meantime, the last week's reporting is up. We will tweet that out for those of you who are listening, who are interested in reading more. We'll also have that up at our website. I want to thank Cynthia Kambabati, who's a data reporter with ProPublica. Jason Grotto is an investigative reporter, both of them with ProPublica Illinois. John Kent has also been with us, a professor emeritus of business administration at the U of I. Guys, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us. Thanks for your good work.
It's day 32 of the partial government shutdown, and it's affected people all across the country in many different ways, whether it's federal workers or contractors missing paychecks, TSA officers calling in sick, national parks and museums being closed. Today, we wanted to look at how sexual assault hotlines in Illinois are being affected. Last week, the Justice Department announced it would officially stop processing funding requests starting on Friday. The Illinois Coalition Against Sexual Assault is still managing to get some funding, but they and other hotlines could be in limbo if this continues. Carrie Ward is its executive director, and she's on the line with me now. Hi, Carrie. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Carrie, how much of your funding for the hotline comes from the federal government?
So right now we receive between 60 and 70% of ICASA's total funding is from the federal government. So our total budget is about $26 million, and we receive about $18 million of that in federal funding.
So Carrie, what has the past month been like for you?
Well, I think for Rape Crisis Centers, they try as hard as they can to do business as usual, to keep responding, providing their 24-hour crisis response to victims, and trying to make sure that they're available at hospitals and law enforcement departments to assist victims who need our services. But I can't say that it's without stress, because we've received a couple different notifications about the status of federal funding with the government shutdown. The agencies that work through the Department of Justice to send dollars to Illinois for Rape Crisis Services have given us a couple different notifications about dates by which they may no longer have funding to submit to us. And so I think that for Rape Crisis Centers, they always have to think forward about what happens if this deadline comes and there's no more funding. You know, what do we do and what does that mean for victims?
What's your next deadline right now then?
So right now, the next deadline that we have is with the Department of Justice for the Office on Victims of Crime, and that deadline is March 1st. They've told us they are able to continue to process payments during this partial government shutdown. They know that they can continue to process payments based on the available funding they have through March 1st, and that they'll keep us updated if that status changes. But right now, what we know is it's business as usual until March 1st, but if nothing changes prior to March 1st, we expect another update on what that means for us.
And so for people who are calling your hotline for the rape crisis counselors that you are sending, as you're saying, to hospitals and police stations, just because the government is shut down doesn't mean that people, unfortunately, obviously, they still need your services. So
exactly.
What do you want people to know about what you all are offering in terms of what you're able to provide right now? Is everything kind of operating as normal?
Yes. What we would want survivors to know right now is that your rape crisis centers in Illinois are open and are providing the services that you are needing, that the 24-hour hotlines are up and running, that sexual assault advocates are responding to hospitals. We fully expect that to continue, that 24-hour crisis response is the lifeblood of what we do. However, what we know is that if the shutdown goes on for a long-term basis, and if we receive notice that either we won't receive all of the federal funding that we were approved for, or that it won't last as long as we had previously expected, then there will certainly be some impact on services. However, rape crisis centers would have to look internally and evaluate what that means. Might there be more waiting lists for counseling services? Might there be fewer counselors or advocates available? Those are all things that could happen because the federal funding is such a huge part of our budget, and it does support direct services. However, we want sexual assault survivors to know, please continue to call our hotlines. Please continue to go to the hospital, the police department. Rape crisis workers will continue to be there for you. But what we know internally on a long-term basis is we can't sustain these services forever without this funding. It's essential. Rape crisis programs don't have, they're not-for-profits. They don't have lots and lots of other funding that could support and fill that gap that those federal funds provide. And so there would absolutely be an impact in the future if there's a cut or a loss of this funding. But we want survivors to know, please keep coming to rape crisis centers. We want our services to be there for you as long as they possibly can.
And Carrie, how many different folks are you working with throughout Illinois? How many counties are you all in?
So there are 102 counties in Illinois, and right now ICASA Rape Crisis Centers are in over 90 counties. We have 30 rape crisis centers across the state and 47 satellite offices that are each affiliated with one of those 30 main offices. And so our reach across Illinois is very far and wide. We do know that there are still some areas, especially down in far southeastern Illinois, and there are some areas in the city of Chicago and suburban Cook County where we still need even more services, but our reach right now is pretty broad.
And I wonder then what your message is to the federal government, to our congressional delegation in Washington, about the, as we're thinking about stability, as we're thinking about you planning for the future and this current partial shutdown situation that we're in?
What I would say is that these services are essential, and these dollars were promised to support these services, that nothing related to the shutdown is the fault of sexual assault victims or survivors and the services that they need. They should be able to receive without having to worry about that, as well as the employees, staff, and volunteers who work for the Rape Crisis Centers. These are essential, important services, as are many of the other services that are challenged by the shutdown right now. And we just really want to see those commitments that were made by the federal government. We want to see those come to fruition.
Carrie mentioned services across Illinois. If you need help, the National Sexual Assault Hotline number is 1-800-656-4673. That's 1-800-656-4673. We'll also have that information up on our website. If you need help or need to find a crisis center in your area, Carrie Ward is the executive director of the Illinois Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Carrie, thank you for taking the time to speak with us this morning.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
That's all the time we have for today. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to be talking about how to beat the winter blues. It's still very cold, snowy, icy out there, and we wonder what go-tos you have for this time of year. Maybe you like to leave the house for some indoor activities or cook something warm and hearty at home. Obviously, you want that to be in January. We're thinking about we want that to be healthy and we want that to be pretty cheap, right? Leave us a voicemail, 217-300-2121, to share your ideas of how you beat the winter blues. That's 217-300-2121. I mentioned our website a couple of times. It's www.21stshow.org, 21stshow.org. That's where we've got information about our social media handles. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, find us on Facebook, just go to 21stshow.org. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Bobby McSwine is our intern. Thanks to Christine Herman for her help today. Technical direction and engineering comes from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boudou. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.